Hello and welcome. I'm Simon.
I am Haney.
I'm Alexander.
And we are Knee Deep in Tech, covering the latest from the IT industry with a specific focus on Microsoft and how to get actual value from technology. This is episode 307, a news episode. You will be able to find this and our previous episodes on kneedeepintech.com, iTunes, Spotify, and on most podcasting platforms. We are back, and for once, and I don't know if that's a good thing, you can see us.
Yep.
But yeah, we had the stressed.
For sure. I mean, this is something that we talked about from the beginning, and in the beginning we did exactly one video episode, and it was absolutely horrible. And we vowed that we're not going to do this for several years. Several years have passed, and apparently all the cool kids are now doing. Is this a video cast, or what do you call it? Video podcast?
A vlog.
No.
Vlog. Please do not make me a vlogger. Anyways, we're gonna see if this works. We're gonna be putting it on YouTube as well. If it doesn't, well, this is another curiosity. We would know if we didn't try it.
Yeah, and to make feel more assured. It says in Riverside, which we use for this recording, that actual recording is higher quality. So I assume that whatever comes out of this will be higher quality than what we produce.
Doesn't quite work that way, but keep dreaming.
AI.
Yes, that will solve everything.
Of course. So, moving on to the news. First and foremost, let's head back to episode 305 and 306, which was all about my brain that was picked to pieces like two surgeons on holiday. And we have received some feedback. So thank you, Reitze, for reaching out and for the feedback. And we hope that others like Reitze found the two episodes interesting and thought-provoking, perhaps. But it was like, I learned a lot about myself. But one thing that Reitze mentioned were apparently a Dutch thing called a black hole. Space might claim that black holes are a part of the universe, but let's call them Dutch for now, where he mentions that, okay, what happens when you finalize your career, you hit retirement, or you change career, or for some reason you can't continue the way that you used to in terms of community engagement and so on. And we all thought that that was a great way to continue the conversation. But your initial thoughts on that and what we might do with it moving forward?
Oh, that's... I've been giving that a lot of thought because we tend to equate... so much, let me see if I can try that again. We tend to imbue so much of our identity in what we do. I think we talked about that during one of the episodes. Like, I was the medic, I was the photographer, I was the insert whatever was needed at the moment. And in many cases, that's just shifted to the community. Mm-hmm. What am I without the community? What am I without doing this work? And if I can't do this work, for reasons, I might decide to stop using computers, or I might not be able to, whatever. That is definitely going to change my perception of myself. Mm-hmm. Probably not everybody else's perception as much as one might think, but definitely my own.
Yeah. I think it's really an interesting discussion, because maybe looking at, you know, some older people that I know, I've very much seen this, where it's like nothing stops once one reaches retirement, and people find maybe like hobby ways to keep doing what they used to do, or in some other variation or things like that. And I personally like to think that I have enough like other things that I would really like to do, like be outdoors, sew, knit, whatever, you know, spend time with family, etc. But to be honest, I don't know if that would actually happen. I think it would actually be much more challenging than I am like putting it in my head in this moment, that it's actually going to be much harder for me than I expect.
Every time I walk through a cemetery, I look at the headstones. And going back just 50, 100 years, everybody had a title. And this is what you were. You were an officer or a policeman or a firefighter or a teacher.
Yeah.
Now, there are a few of those titles that you gain, and then you are that for life, pretty much. Priest, doctor. That doesn't necessarily mean that you work as a medical doctor, but you are and you will always be a doctor. That's an interesting identity situation, I think, which is way more interesting than Entra.
Well said.
Nice one.
But we absolutely want to revisit this discussion, probably with Simon's brain part three or somebody else's brain. There are a few to go around. So let's park this and pick it up at a later time, and let's dive into the news.
Yeah. And the first thing that I would like to talk about, which is also more interesting than Entra, is the updated device configuration templates for Windows Delivery Optimization, which might sound incredibly boring, and I would fully understand that. But this is actually where Haney and I have a shared interest, because this is going into networking.
Ooh, okay, I'm listening.
Yeah, I thought as much. So
this was going so well.
And then we head into networking. We'll be mentioning words like VLAN, subnets, and other network thingies in the coming 5 minutes.
That was the grand total of all your networking knowledge, right?
Exactly. I'm just about. So, do you know what delivery optimization is?
I have an idea. I'll take a stab at it. That is that it is slightly more clever than just pushing all the updates to everyone and their cats. It's either pre-staging it or sharing it between end machines.
Sort of kind of both. But the main thing is that it shares between machines on the same network or even on the internet. So it was actually born out of Xbox, because Microsoft had a need to optimize the data transfer from their servers to the Xboxes, especially when the games are hundreds of gigabytes today and Microsoft actually pays for their bandwidth. So this was born out of update and network efficiency on Microsoft's behalf, but it of course benefits all of us, and it's turned on by default in all Windows systems. So if they can, they will try to share updates between devices on the same network or on the internet. This is something we can use if we wanted to be slightly more intelligent than what Microsoft currently provides, because the default setup is that it's sharing content behind the same external IP address or the same NAT, which might be very inefficient depending on how advanced your network actually is. So before we continue this conversation, we'll head into the new templates. And within Intune, you have the concepts of configuration profiles, which, by the sound of it, configures something on your endpoint. And to make that simpler for you, Microsoft provides templates that are pre-made configurations that you could use to apply to your devices if you need assistance in how to set them up. And they have been updated for delivery optimization, and is also modernized using the new settings catalog and things like that. And that news item in itself isn't too big, but I really want to emphasize the importance of delivery optimization and how to start using it. So that's why we are talking about it. This is where the network component comes in. So I listened to Martin Imken, I think that's how I pronounce his surname, one of the newer Intune MVPs, at Microsoft Modern Endpoint Management Summit, sorry, in Paris a few weeks ago. And he talked about how to speak to your network team because that's essential for success for many of us. And he talked a lot about
it's a skill.
It is, because like he said, if I tell you are the network person here now, Haney, if I tell you I need you to open these firewall ports for me, what's your initial response to that?
No.
Exactly. Because I'm now poking at your security perimeter. Mm-hmm. So we need to figure out a way to do that. And this is especially important when it comes to delivery optimization, given how it works. Things like subnet design, VLANs, NAT, all of those things that we, by speaking to the network team, can optimize and therefore optimize the content distribution, limiting the load on the network and be more efficient with updates. So if you haven't worked with your delivery optimization configuration, look into it because it will probably assist you a lot. And I think we might get back to how to do this. And it would be really fun to do a find someone that's even more network geeky than you are, Haney, and talk
yes,
about.
Yes, I'm definitely not on the geekiest end at all.
We need to find someone that talks about IPv6.
Yes.
Probably. But I think that's something we can also get back to, like how to talk to other parts that we have dependencies on. Mm-hmm. The second news item, which is Alexander's favorite, is that we now finally have a lot of new AI features coming to the Copilot Plus PCs. Since we are on video, who in here have a Copilot Plus PC? Amy, this is your cue. Good.
I'm like, what PC do I have? I have a PC.
The one I recommend.
That's how much I care.
That didn't.
Oh, wait a minute, Haney. You have the one PC where your pen does not work. Is that the one?
Yes. Because apparently I am strange. Most people don't use a PC like I do.
No, because it's an AI PC. So, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So, the one of the biggest releases of new AI features for the Copilot Plus PCs has just been pushed in the latest optional update ring for Windows. So we'll now get recall. We'll get the improved Windows search. So you don't have to search for an actual file name. You can search for the content of that file. So if I want to find this picture I made in a PowerPoint presentation, I can search for the content of that picture and get the search result back.
And that's Cortana, right?
Yes, everything is Cortana. Like, don't open that box, please. I was in a good mood and then I miss Cortana.
What is happening?
But it doesn't work.
Kidding.
I have it. And it's apparently, you can flash it to work like a Spotify speaker. So I need to make it work. And for the ones of you that don't see this, I'm holding up the Harman Kardon Invoke, I think the official name were, a Microsoft's attempt to beat Alexa, I would say. But I absolutely love it. It didn't fly.
It sort of kind of went the same way as Windows Phone.
Like I said, I loved Windows Phone. I loved Azure Remote App. Yeah, let's continue. We have all of these new AI features. You can soon get them on any Copilot Plus PC. Yes, for recall, you need to enable it. You can always opt out. And we'll probably get back to that at a later stage to deep dive into the capabilities of recall, how it works, because I can't wait to enable it on my Copilot Plus PC.
Two questions on the recall. Mm-hmm. One, do you need an AI computer to do it, or does recall work on anything? And yeah, I speaking
Alexander
of turning something off.
All the cool Mac stuff.
That was not planned, but sure. So, yes, do you need an AI capable machine to run Recall?
Yes, you need a Copilot Plus PC. So okay, it doesn't work with just any AI. Yeah. So my old Surface Pro X doesn't work, but any Copilot Plus PC, it works.
So yet another reason to avoid the Copilot Plus PC. Thank you. My second question is, and this is a serious one, how does security professionals view Recall? Because even if it's a great tool, I'm not debating that. It might be absolutely awesome. The potential... Well, suddenly you have a new reason for attacking a end user because there's a crap ton of potentially really interesting information in the Recall database or whatever you want to call it. What is the perspective of security professionals? Because I clearly call you one of those.
Oh, thank you. My personal opinion is that it's much, much better than it were before. I think Microsoft had a different vision for what Recall were supposed to be, much more similar to how Apple does it, where you were able to transfer this data between your devices, which would have made sense from a functionality point of view, but made it very complicated from a security standpoint. Now you need to unlock it using Windows Hello, which makes it very secure. It's protected using the TPM of the device. So I would say that, yes, of course, if someone could get access to your device, somehow get in by using your PIN code or whatever, yes, it's there. But a lot of the things that you have in the memory and the cache of Recall, you can figure out in other ways too. Like, it won't take pictures of passwords or any secrets.
You can't say that.
Of course I can.
Of course you can. But we all know that it will absolutely take a screenshot of something that the algorithm does not see as anything potentially issue. Yeah. But it might be. So
That's the selling point. So my opinion, I will use it. And I will probably use it on my work device too. But I will be considering what I allow it to take pictures of and not, because that is totally in the user's control. I can exclude URLs. I can exclude applications because it's a user feature. Admins have no reason to use it for anything else other than their own personal gain. So it's not that you turn it on and your admins will start to see everything. You turn it on for yourself if you want it to be there. The only control your admins have is, should you allow the users to turn it on? And are there URLs and apps that the organization don't want Recall to take pictures of? So let's say HR or finance applications don't allow that.
Makes sense.
But that's probably not what I will use it for. I will use it for blog posts, search results, PowerPoints, whatever. But let's get back to Recall, because we have other interesting things too. But we will dive into it now when I can try it. I've tried it during Ignite when I demoed it for a lot of people. I convinced a lot of people of the security of it. And I think that if you hack Recall, you have other considerations in terms of security. If you break Windows Hello, TPM, all of that. But that great question.
Sense. So that brings us actually to security things. So a couple of episodes back, I mentioned the disappearing update, and that was Key Vault in Fabric and getting Key Vault connections in Fabric. So Key Vault is this place where you store secrets, and you can give someone the read access to Key Vault to read the content of the secret without seeing the secret in itself. So this is a way of giving access to a service principal to read information that then gets passed into a login, for instance. And nowhere doing all these things is the actual password displayed in a readable format. So it's a complete no-brainer. Anything you build in Azure should absolutely use the Key Vault. Simple as. This has not been easy or even possible in a lot of instances in Fabric. This is now being rectified, finally, thank God. The theory is great. The implementation is not. And this goes back to, in my perspective, the horribly unenterprisey view on security that the Fabric has. Who is, or what is the security context of anything running? Well, it depends. So if you run a pipeline will run as the last person that changed the schedule. Nice. Mm-hmm. But if it runs a notebook, that notebook will run under the security context of Fabric, the workspace identity, regardless of who started it. Okay. But so the question then becomes, if you have a pipeline that talks to a data source and that runs as me because I'm running the pipeline, which security context will be querying the Key Vault? According to the documentation, the workspace identity should get read access on the Key Vault, which is perfect. That's the way that I would expect it to be. Unless there's something magical happening, it's not working that way. It says in the documentation that's what's supposed to happen. The read access is not applied. So I have yet to try it out. And yes, it is in preview. But yeah, we have a lot of issues with security and automation and enterpriseability, if that's a word, in Fabric as it is. And this is not really helping. This is exposing a lot of those issues. So yay for Key Vault, nay for the way that it's built in at this specific moment.
What about the Security First initiative that Microsoft promised to commit to?
Well, security first, something else. No, it's, yeah. And speaking of security, you might be aware of the Azure Maps, the successor to Bing Maps. And these, so mapping in Power BI has been a sore thumb for quite a while. You could not share maps through Power BI. It broke. Now Azure Maps are there and they work absolutely fantastic, but be aware that Azure Maps might send data to be processed outside of your geographic region. This is not a secret. It is stated clearly in the documentation, but as Fabric will transition over and make Azure Maps default, yeah, you see where I'm going with this, it will require you to make a choice. There are endpoints in Europe. There are endpoints in America. There are endpoints in Asia, or Asia Pacific. But it doesn't necessarily mean that processing will happen in your specific area, so it might go away. Just so you're aware of that. I wanted to highlight two blog posts. One is by Valerie Jung of Porq BI. She has done arguably the most boring type of report that you can ever create, which is a profit and loss statement. It's the antithesis to anything that is ever done in Power BI, but hey, a lot of people want to do P&L reports, and most of them do it in either in Excel or they buy a third-party visual to do it. But she had an idea, and she's like a dog with a bone. She didn't let it go and figured out how to do a pretty slick P&L statement. And she now has a blog post up, and I highly recommend you to go look at it because it's a work of art. And if it's not something that you might need, it definitely gives you some insights into how you can think when you want to do something similar. Finally, Kurt Bueller has been at it again, and he has created a wonderful graphic of essentially all the third-party tools that are available for Power BI. So if you want to have a think about, take for instance, where does, suddenly my website is not loading, there we go. Suddenly, so where does DAX Studio fit in? Well, that's the test part or the optimize part of a life cycle. Where does PBI Inspector go in and what are they used for? He put everything into one beautiful graphic all over at sqlbi.com where you can just get an idea where in the life cycle does this specific tool make most sense. So really, really useful, if nothing else, to explain to other users where do you find what capabilities and what tools.
Very cool. On my side of the fence, well, I have sad news first. A little bit, a while back, when the Azure updates page got updated and it was really difficult to find anything, I didn't even get it to display anything. I told you all that there is this site called Azure Charts that has updates in a nice format where you can also easily kind of see the icons and filter the view based off of that. But unfortunately, that page is off. You can go and check it. And they are kind of stating that if it's burdening you, what is the right word? If you were really using the page and it was helping you, you should contact your Microsoft contact. So clearly, there is something bizarre there. I have to say the Azure updates, like the official site now, works better than it used to, but I really like the layout of this Azure Charts page, and I'm a little bummed that it's no longer available, especially since I'm a bit of a visual person, so it helps to have the icons and I can spot things easier than reading every single topic. So that is a bit of a side note. On the other hand, there is quite less updates at the moment because Build will be coming soonish. Mm-hmm. So it seems like there is a little bit more of a quiet stage happening at this particular stage. And I think you also saw it on your side of the fence as well a little bit. Yeah. But there was some interesting networking things that came out. Yes. So there is the public preview of virtual network TAP. TAP. Do you know what is a TAP?
Temporary access pass in Entra.
No.
No.
We're talking about networking. Yeah. But in Entra, yes. In the Azure virtual network context, it is a terminal access point. And what it allows you to do is essentially use it as kind of this gateway, one could say, to send your network traffic to, for example, a network traffic collector or a network traffic analytics tool, for example, and have that as kind of the point that routes it forward. So normally with a lot of the solutions, you would need some kind of agent on the network, and most of the time it will also create some overhead on top of the network traffic. So this is kind of built now using the Azure networking capabilities. So it kind of mirrors the traffic to go also to this network collector or analytics tool that you might be using.
Is this a virtual version of the network port mirroring feature that you have on a switch, for instance? But on a software level?
Yeah. Yeah, it actually is very much like that.
Yeah, you are mirroring, but previously you didn't have a good, I would say, a good connectivity point for the appliances that you need to then collect and make some use of the traffic you're mirroring.
Yeah,
so I think this just makes it easier to do the mirroring without having to set up the network infrastructure on your own.
Yeah, we all remember the horrible forced tunneling that was the only option previously. Okay, cool.
We don't all remember you, that, course, Alex.
You, of course, still need the network analytics tool that you're going to use. And that would be, for example, a network virtual appliance in Azure. So that might mean some virtual machines and things like that, where you have your tooling and things like that. But this just eases the routing of traffic to the right place for you. And then, as the second neat thing, I will call it neat, is that there is something called Azure Storage Actions that are now generally available. And what the Azure Storage Actions bring to the game, it is kind of this it kind of reminds me of like Reflex in Fabric, but at a larger scale, scaled to Azure Storage. It's not, of course, it's not the same as Reflex in Fabric, but it just reminds me of that. So the idea of this is that if you have a, like you might be, for example, using Blob Storage or Azure Data Lake Storage to store a lot of data. So what the Azure Storage Actions is there to do is to help you with management of that data. And essentially what you would do is create some conditions and then what is done based off of those conditions. And the actions is able to kind of scan your entire storage estate in your storage account and do those actions for all your data. So for example, you might need to archive some data that has been in your storage account for a specific time, or it has been unmodified for a specific time. So you could then automate that with Azure Storage Actions. You might also, let's see, you don't need to create your own kind of custom scripts to do certain things, but you have a little bit of kind of built-in capabilities that are included in your Azure Storage Actions. So you have been able to earlier do similar things using like the Azure CLI and even some of the policies that are available. But this definitely gives like a more structured way to define those rules and have them in one place. And then, for example, like continuously do that processing for your data in your storage account. And of course, the more you have data, the more you have files, the more efficient this will be for you, like in comparison of like how much manual effort do you not need to do in comparison. That sentence went backwards. But essentially, you have the condition. So for example, it could be like a specific creation time of the file that you are checking, if it's before 5 days ago or before like over a week ago that it has been created, do something. Then there is the operation itself that defines what do you do to the storage. It could even delete data, archive it, whatever it needs to do. And then the assignment is assigning that to a specific storage account, to certain objects, etc. So then you are able to also like assign the same tasks across multiple of your storage accounts as well. So I feel it's neat. I think that's the right way to describe it. And it kind of brings home the point that even though sometimes we think that, well, Azure storage is just storage. And in a way, it is just storage. But there are also these capabilities coming in that then make kind of the management of that storage much easier as well. So it's kind of taking it to the next level.
Yeah. Indeed, really interesting. I've been looking through the article, and my first thought when you were talking about putting things into storage, that was the lifecycle management, and word that I would use to describe that is clunky,
yes,
and very very limited in scope. There are a couple of times where I wanted it to be way more clever on how it decides on what files to shift to archive or to cold storage. But this looks like the perfect fit for those scenarios.
Mm. Yeah. And it's, of course, other things than archiving as well. You could set like an immutability policy on the file or well, multiple, anything you can do with a file in a storage account. You could essentially put that into the operation. And then you can also define what do you do if this succeeds, because it could be also that the operation succeeds or fails. So then you of course need to handle that. What happens if that comes across? So I believe on the fail, at least at the moment, the only option there is to break. So it breaks at that point. But it's just based on the kind of how it's formulated. It maybe sounds like there might be other things coming in as well as options.
Cool.
And you can have multiple operations and, you know, you get this flexibility.
Because that's something that I've talked about with some other community members in terms of the main question is really, why should we buy third-party tools that do automation for us? Mm. Or in this case, a first-party product that does automation for us, which probably comes at a cost, when we could write it on our own? And what is the benefit of that? And we have had a really interesting discussion. So it would be, and that's also one of the cases here from one of the customers that I've asked or spoken to in the article, that we could eliminate multiple resource-heavy automation runbooks and use this instead.
Exactly.
So when should you do what? How should you think about building automation rather than acquiring or implementing ready-made automations?
Indeed.
Mm-hmm. Before we quit, I think it was last week, Microsoft released a blog post on their announcements for new European digital commitments. That's something we'll talk about in our next episode and our view on what's going on in the world. We might have opinions. There might be smoke and there might be mirrors. But stay tuned for our next episode. We'll talk about what's going on in the world.
Is it
going to
be white smoke or black smoke?
Clever. We'll see when this episode comes out if it's black or white smoke. And also, Microsoft Intune have a new logo. And on that absolutely ridiculous news item, it's time to end. Thank you so much for looking at us, for listening to us, and we hope you enjoyed one of them at least, and that you will continue your knee-deep in tech journey with us next week. But until then, thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Have a good one.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of knee-deep in tech. Knee-deep in Tech is a weekly technology podcast hosted by Alexander Arvidsson, Simo Binder, and Heini Ilmarinen. If you have any feedback, questions, or would like to be part of an episode, please reach out to us on social media or via email at podcast@knee-deep-in-tech.com.